pleasure to introduce Ian Cuso, who is also a participant in our workshop, small, much smaller workshop that we ran 3 years ago here at IPAM. Ian is from, recently from two places, the Department of Zoology and Center for Mathematical Biology at Oxford and the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Princeton. The title of his talk will be Collective Motion and Decision Making in Animal Groups.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so this is really a follow-on from the previous talk, and I'm afraid there's a few of the videos, I haven't deleted them, but they're the same ones that Steve showed, so I hope you like them, because you're going to see them again. But here's one that you haven't seen. So we're really interested in things like collective behavior, where you get functional complexity within these large groups arising from repeated interactions among the individuals. And these are, some, in my mind, certainly some of the most spectacular ones, these very highly coordinated ones in schools of silversight fish, and this here is the European starling filmed on the Somerset Levels in England. And typically, what some of the properties we're particularly interested in are how individuals interacting locally, say for example these sheep here, tend to align with each other relatively locally, how they tend to reconcile that local information with some sort of global goal-oriented behavior. For example, these individuals may also have some knowledge about a general migration route, but they may be reconciling that with these local tendencies. But individuals also interact with their external environment, you know, whether it's resources, as Steve was discussing, or in this case, this person is perceived by these sheep as a threat, and you can see they maintain a vacuole around themselves. And it's really nice when you see these pictures from above, because it really gives you a sense of how this kind of work relates to work that's going on in cells, and even some work in physics. And that's why we're so excited to be talking to you guys about these kind of things, because we want to be able to scale from individual interactions to collective properties, and also go the other way, where we're interested in how the collective properties that are generated by the interactions feed back in a recursive loop to the individual behaviors. And so I'll be discussing some of these things. So why do we study animal groups? Well, they're really important. You know, these kind of groups are ubiquitous. And if we're interested in, you know, gene flow in populations, if we're interested in migration, or even conservation of species in fragmented environments, we need to understand these types of scaling properties. I mean, it's really a unifying feature of all ecology, is this issue of scaling. And I think in fields like mathematics and physics, people have been thinking along these lines for a very long time, but it's newer to us. And hopefully we can also provide some interesting experimental systems to test these ideas. Because these animal groups, you can take them apart, you can put them back together again. And as Steve Simpson showed, you can do these very detailed experiments at the level of the individual and sort of scale up to say, how does that then relate to population properties? And the types of interactions and behaviors are also relevant at a microscopic scale. Here's some work that I've been doing with John Bonner at Princeton, looking at cellular swarms. Again, individuals feeding back with their environment here, creating a cellular swine and interacting with each other. So the principles apply across scales. And Naomi Leonard will talk about some very interesting applications in the technological domain, where perhaps we can be inspired by the types of solutions that biological organisms have found, for example, to collectively explore space, and really apply them to these types of systems. So we really use an integrative approach. So we do some theory, as I'll show you here, but we also think it's very important to link this in through the laboratory and field experiments with the real biological organisms. And I think the story that Steve was discussing with the cannibalism is a very good example of why, you know, looking at the real organisms sometimes completely shifts your perspective on what we really mean by collective behavior, what are the fundamental principles underlying collective behavior. So sometimes when we actually know what we're talking about, we can do specific models to test specific hypotheses. But because this is a relatively new area, a lot of the models that I'm going to be discussing, I'm going to start off with a specific detailed model, but then move on to some sufficiently abstract models because we want to generate generic concepts and try and cross between these different disciplines. And we also sometimes have to create minimalist models because we just don't know what's going on. So these just give us a way of thinking about the problem. But as I mentioned, we can do these highly controlled experiments using the types of tracking software that Danny Grunbaum and that we've developed. You can begin to interrogate real systems. But, you know, it's really important to test these under natural conditions, as Steve showed. And all of these different properties feed back into generating ideas. Sometimes the ideas come from what we see when we go out say to Panama or to Mauritania, and see the real animals. Other times you're sitting away in your lab, you know, working away on a computer, and suddenly the model gives you a clue about what's going on. So we feel that we have to work together with theoreticians and lab experimentalists and field experimentalists to really push this field forwards. So I'm going to talk about a series of things, going from some more detailed work on a specific problem relating to traffic in ants, through some more recent work looking at motion and work published last year on collective decision-making within these types of groups. And then I'm going to return to the system that Steve introduced, which is the locust hoppermans that we're doing a lot of work on now. And I actually decided to chuck this in just before, because I suddenly remembered that we were directly inspired from the last IPAM meeting to do some work on the hopping behavior of locusts using a theoretical framework. And it would be an appropriate time, perhaps, to sort of reintroduce that topic here. So ant traffic. Well, we're used to traffic within our societies. You know, an efficient transportation system is absolutely essential for the functioning and success of our modern human cities, but we're not the only organisms to live within societies. These ants here, it's called Esetomb Vercelli, or the army ants, live within these large colonies of about 1.5 million individuals. And they're such voracious predators, and the colonies are so large that they don't really have time to go and dig a nest and live somewhere, because they're going to devastate all of the area around them. So they actually make a nest out of their own living body. They've got special hooks that hold their legs together. And if you look at the individuals, they've actually almost completely lost their eyesight. They really are as close to robots as you get in the natural world. They've really become incredibly simplified, because almost everything happens at the level of the collective. And this is the bivouac, that's the nest there. And you can see they can stretch out to create a foraging swarm over 100 meters, even though the individual ants are less than a centimeter long. I mean, this is just one of the most remarkable natural phenomena. If you actually go out to South America or Central America, and you see these, you know, literally the blind leading the blind in this coordinated way, it's remarkable. And this just gives you a feel for what it's like at a sort of ant-level view of these swarms. And you can see that collectively, even though they can't see, you know, they'll bump into prey, and collectively they'll release chemicals that cause other ants to aggregate, and they'll pull it apart. They've actually got quite a powerful sting as well, as anyone who works in the nose. You can see they even create living bridges of their bodies. They can actually have simple rules that allow them to bridge gaps. And you can see them retrieving prey here that they've ripped apart. And you can even see cooperative prey too. Here's a bridge again. And here you can see groups of ants returning prey collectively. And this here is about 5 foot high wall of living ants. This is a nest in Panama, on Barra Colorado Island. This is one of the largest nests actually ever filmed. It was just before this nest, the way they reproduce is they get larger, 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 and then split into two. And about a week after we filmed this, this colony actually divided. So this is one of the largest colonies you'll see. And if we zoom in, you can see these relatively simple individuals with, you know, that have lost their vision. And you can see them hooking their bodies together. And that's a brood item. That's like there's a baby ant in there. You can see them underneath. And they can actually thermoregulate by changing the gap there to let air in and let air out, so they can keep the temperature regulated within these nests. And you can see the huge scimitar mandibles. And when that individual bites, its jaws lock. But the natives there used to use them to stitch together wounds, because once the jaws are locked, you can just snip the body off, and it holds you there. Now, this is quite different to the locusts. These individuals are all female, and they're all sisters. So they're working for the benefit of the colony. So here we have a case where we have selfless individuals. So collectively, it's almost like cells in a body. It's like a super organism. And later on, we'll then move to selfish individuals within these groups. But it's important to realize that, you know, what appears to be cooperative behavior, as Steve showed, isn't necessarily cooperative. But in this case, we have highly cooperative individuals. So the first stage is to understand the individual level. How do individual ants follow these chemical trails? And then we want to understand, have they evolved movement rules to minimize congestion on these trail systems at a collective level? And so if you go back to the literature, you know, even in the sort of 60s and throughout the 80s, people did a lot of experiments using artificial trails. You can actually chemically either extract them from living ants or create artificial trails. And you can see that the ants will have this sort of sinusoidal trajectory as they wander along the trail. Now, if you do experiments in the lab where you modify the concentration of the chemical on the trail, and this is the distance the ants follow the trail before they lose it, you can see something that appears to be counterintuitive. So as concentration increases, the ants become better able to follow a trail, which is perhaps what we'd expect. But above a critical concentration, the ants then become less able to follow the chemical again. So any model needs to be able to explain these types of properties before we can then move on to look at the collective behavior.
Excuse me, what was on the y-axis?
That was the distance the ants follow along the trail before they lose it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll return to this later, but this is just generally trail following ability increasing as concentration increases and then decreases again.
This was the ant concentration?
This is the chemical concentration of the pheromone trail, yes. And so we can, you know, begin to understand the system by using a computer model where ants can detect the concentration at their left and their right antennae, and they can also locally detect the bodies of other ants. In the case of the army ants, that would be like a physical tactile contact. In the case of locusts, they may also strongly involve contact. But you could also imagine this to be a local visual range in other species. You know, one could extend this model to termites or other species of ants. And we can then simulate the diffusion equation using continuous diffusion to try and understand how does an ant follow a segment of trail. And so we need to get inside the brain of the individual. Unfortunately for us, physiologists have already mapped out how the nerve firing rate changes as a function of concentration. So as you increase what you can do is you can put a tiny little electrode into the antenna and record the firing rates of the nerves coming from that antenna. And then you can puff chemical at them. And this is the concentration of that chemical showing the nerve firing rate increasing and then saturating, as you'd expect from Michaelis Menten kinetics. And what we can then do is just use this simple concept and create a simple functional form here that shows the saturating function within this virtual ant. And we can then assume that there's also noise in the sensory system, or perhaps noise in the environment. You know, any sensory system has some degree of noise. It could be turbulence in the air. And we want then to translate this to a movement rule. So very simply, what we assume the ants are doing is recording the firing rate from the two antennae with some noise and simply turning towards what it perceives as the highest firing rate. And that alone is sufficient to explain this peak distribution that we get within these experiments. But the advantage of doing a model is that we can go inside it and try and have a look to see why. So if you consider this to be the concentration profile of the trail, so the red dotted line to be the center of the trail, and this is just the concentration of chemical. An ant, if she's sitting in the middle of the trail there, she's hardly going to have any difference between the firing rate of her antennae. So she's likely to lose the center of the trail, but when she gets towards the end, when the slope is much sharper, she's more correctly, even in the presence of noise, to correctly determine the direction of the chemical gradient. So she swings back in, but when she gets to the center, she can overshoot, and she can then bounce off the sides of the trail, creating this sinusoidal trajectory. Now, if you imagine this trail to be very, very thin, a very small chemical concentration, you can see any mistake that she makes means she loses the trail. As we increase the concentration, you can see she can bounce off the sides. But if you imagine this to be a very flat, platykirtic distribution of highly concentrated chemical, two things occur. One, the chemical can saturate the antenna, in which you can't tell correctly the right direction. The other is because it's platykirtic and flat in the middle, there's a large area in which you can turn perpendicular to the swarm, and when you're to the trail, and when you're perpendicular, it's very difficult to correctly detect the gradient. And so that explains why, as you increase the concentration on these artificial trails and these virtual trails, that the ants become better able to, and then less able to follow the chemical. But what about if we put ants together? How then do the interactions among the individuals lead to collective behavior? And so in the case of the ants, we just have a simple model in which the ants avoid each other. So there's no attraction in the system. All we have is repulsion. So they have this taxis ability along chemical trails, and they have the ability to avoid colliding with each other by slowing down and turning. And one of the things you get when you take these ants into a box, you know, you take out a few hundred ants. Initially, they walk around at random, laying chemical. Then they begin following each other's chemicals. And what you get is a trail system spontaneously emerging, whereby the ants will rotate around in what we call a mill, and they'll do that for 10, 12 hours until they literally die of exhaustion. I mean, these are not the smartest animals out there. You know, what they're doing, though, is they're, you know, if you take them out, this may seem like an aberrant behavior. But in actual fact, it characterizes the essence of what it's like to be an ant. then that you're following chemical trails, and you have this collective ability to sort of send your swarm outwards. So initially we'll discuss this, and then later on we'll discuss the case where we have bidirectional flow. So can we, when we have our little virtual ants following this dotted line, which this indicates for you the center of this artificial sort of virtual chemical trail, are there repulsion rules that can be evolved by these ants that allow them to collectively select the same direction? And indeed, we found that there were. And it related to the turning rate of the individual and the range over which they could perceive other individuals. So in this region here, this peak here, shows you the region in which they will collectively select a direction. And so what we have here are periodic boundary conditions at this end and this end. So we can simulate, you know, a reasonable number of individuals, characterize a typical subsection of trail. But it also sort of reminds us of that sort of torus-type formation, because we have this end, of course, connected to this end in our simulation. And if the turning rate is very, very low, or the angle of perception is low, the ants are quite insensitive to each other. So they'll spend a lot of time slowing down and slowly turning apart. If we go to the other extreme, where turning rate is very, very high, or the angle of perception is very high, they spend a huge amount of time interacting with each other, and they're constantly flipping in states. So they'll just barely nudge another ant, and that will cause it to turn around. And so the system just keeps flipping. And it's only at this region of parameter space here where the ants are sufficiently sensitive, but not too sensitive to each other, that we get collective motion. So what about bidirectional traffic? Well, when we go out to Panama, we can use the digital tracking software to track the motion of ants along the trails. So once the ants have all swept out and raided an area, then they begin to bring food back. So we get ants going in both directions. And what we find is that ants, these are real ants in Panama, returning to the nest are shown in black dots. And the ants that are leaving the nest are shown in a sort of red color. And what you can see, perhaps, is that there seems to be a structure, a spatial structure of ants along these trails. And if you look in detail at these real ants now, and the arrows here represent the points at which they collided with each other, you can see that this ant returning to the nest tends not to really turn when she collides with other individuals, whereas ants that are leaving the nest tend to turn very sharply during these collision events. So there seems to be an asymmetry between the ants that are leaving the nest here and the ants returning to the nest here and the ants leaving the nest here. And this is just quantifying this three-lane structure on these real ant trails. And this quantifies the difference, the asymmetry in turning rates. So again, we can go back to simulation to try and get an understanding of how does this difference in turning rate scale to collective properties? How does it scale to the flow rate of ants along these trails? And we can also look at the ants' ability to know which way they're going along the trail. We don't know how they do that, but they have a sense of direction, and we can modify that within the model. So the optimal weighting for that sense of direction was to equally bias your desire to move in a given direction with your repulsive potential. But what we found was that the asymmetry in turning rate, as we increased that, the flow rate of the colony increased, and just as it plateaus there, spontaneously we get a three-lane structure emerging in our simulation model. And importantly, even though flow rates increased here, we still only have one lane in our simulation. It's only just as you get to this sort of plateau, just where flow rate's optimized, that we spontaneously go from a single-lane system to a multi-lane system within our simulation. And if we compare exactly the same statistics for our simulated ants and the real army ants, this gives us a strong suggestion that the ants have actually evolved to be in this region of parameter space. It's not just that when you're carrying something, you're less maneuverable. You know, it would be very unlikely that they've reached exactly this region of parameter space if they hadn't really evolved these types of rules. And so, well, you know, when this was published, people thought, great, we can understand how these ants optimize flow and minimize congestion. Can we relate this to other systems, such as human systems? And I was, of course, extremely cautious when talking about this, because I know that the ants are all related to each other, that they're all doing it for the benefit of the colony. Whereas when we deal with people, you know, we tend to be much more selfish, and we just want to minimize our own travel time, perhaps at the expense of others. But as you can see, we too spontaneously form lanes. So we actually seem to be adjusting our travel rules in a more dynamic way, such that you tend to sort of, in a sense, optimize your individual rule set over time in your life, and you can actually take people that have no experience of crowds and put them in a crowded environment, and they're rubbish. They spend a huge amount of time colliding. It seems that we actually slowly optimize our strategy within these crowds, and again, we can use similar types of models to simulate the behavior of people within crowds to begin to understand these types of flow patterns. Oops. So moving on to another system.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Am I confusing your page?
Yeah.
Before that, with the ants, I was just curious, you could explain with this model the fact that the ones that are coming back are in the middle, the other ones on the outside. Mm-hmm. But there's this branching pattern that you have. Yeah. When they start splitting, and as far as I remember when you showed the picture, there's also a certain structure, like the first, when it's a bigger density, there's a lower probability of branching, and then as you move to the tips, they branch more and more. Can you also explain that with this?
Or? Yeah, so it's a really, really good point. And what we then did after filming straight sections of trails was film junctions to try and understand what's going on at a junction, because this doesn't simply scale to junctions. And you do get junctions in very, very densely packed sections of trail. Now, we haven't analyzed those data, but if you look at it, you actually get sort of self-organized vortices sometimes forming. And I know Dirk Helbing has sort of found this in some of his human pedestrian models, that you get this spontaneous sort of roundabout formation. Now that, I think, I mean, we've put in a grant proposal to get someone to really focus on those types of questions and also to extend some of the modeling. So that's really very good.
So there's more to it than just...
Yeah, I think the junctions are really interesting. Also, if you look at those big individuals with the big mandibles, there are very few of them in the population, relatively. I mean, they're like a special caste to defend the colony, but you often find them at junctions.
Oh.
And is it because they're big and cumbersome and they just kind of pile up there? But they're often actually in the middle of that junction and ants are sort of sweeping around them. And in other areas of trail, where there's a sharp corner, you find a whole line, a wall of ants on that side. Almost, I mean, it's hard to interpret these things without doing rigorous experimentation, but it's almost as if they're forming like a buffer around the edge, and that which actually guides the ants around. And if you look at the African army ants, along there, almost every corner they have this sort of line of ants on the outside, which seems to be sort of, you know, increasing the flow rate. And you also find, you know, they create these big bridges, but even if you give them a rough surface, small ants will just sit in the gaps and just to allow the surface to be smoother. So there are many more interesting things. Those bridges as well have never been studied, and that would be really cool to try and understand the flow patterns. So within these other systems, again, we resort to using individual-based modeling because it's very difficult to scale up from the individual rules to the collective behavior. And as biologists, what we want to do is sort of get inside the head of these individuals and try and understand what makes them tick. Now, I'm going to talk about some very abstract models in this domain, but I'm really looking forward to the work by Danny Grunbein, where they've looked at real fish and really trying to infer what real fish do. So we can create equations of motion whereby, you know, these fish exist in space and they have a directionality of motion, and we can then look to see how they interact with each other. For example, if they get too close, they may tend to avoid each other, but it's dangerous to be isolated from these groups. So if you're isolated, you may be attracted, or perhaps you're aligned to the direction of travel of other individuals, much like those sheep that I showed earlier. But what happens? How can we then scale to larger groups? And this is really where the simulations become very important. So as a first approximation, we can simulate individuals moving through three-dimensional space, and perhaps repelling from each other within a local radius, and perhaps attracting each other over a more distant radius. And we can then modify, if we want to, the range in which they will tend to align their directions of travel with one another. Now, if we just have repulsion and attraction, what we get is a mosquito-type swarm. So we don't get parallel polarized motion, certainly not for large group sizes. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start introducing this alignment zone in here and see what happens. So you'll see this zone sort of slowly increasing in size. All other parameters in the model are kept constant. Oh, and this just represents a sort of blind zone behind the individual. And as we increase the size of the zone slightly, the group will spontaneously adopt a sort of donut-like torus formation. There's nothing in the rules that say go in a circle. you know, they'll spontaneously adopt this pattern.
Excuse me, what is it, as you did, you just change the range? I mean, what does the figure mean?
That's right, so I just changed this range here. So previously, there was no ability for the individuals to align their direction of travel. They were just repelled to others that were in this zone, or attracted to individuals in this zone. And now what I'm doing is they're repelled from individuals in this zone, attracted to individuals in this zone, and tend to align with individuals within this zone here.
Okay.
And now I'm going to increase that alignment zone further, and this is what we would typically think of as a sort of fish school or a bird flock, this sort of dynamically moving group. And in actual fact, if you look at the statistical properties of these groups, in terms of the nearest neighbor distances, angles, and so on, it's remarkably similar to real fish schools. And this type of rotating donut-type pattern is seen time and time again, particularly in predatory fish species. And it's thought that they do this because they need to keep in the same place, perhaps, because it's a good foraging region, but they need to sleep. And they also need to keep water flowing over the gills, or else they'll drown. So they need to keep oxygen flowing over the gills. And so this could perhaps be a formation they can adopt, where everyone is in the slipstream of everyone else, but as a group, you can stay in the same area, and then the next day, you can start foraging.
And so you make these two zones, and then you give them some sort of a motion. Is that just a random motion that you give to observe as a surprise that they then form what you have shown us?
Yeah, they have a constant, in this particular model, they have a constant speed.
You give them?
Yes. So they're self-propelled particles, they have a constant speed. I'm sorry, shouldn't make that more clear. I'm too used to talking to biologists and they don't want to see any of the equations in the model. But it's a very simple model where individuals move at constant speed and all we're adjusting is the bearing, is the heading of the individuals, as a function of whether they're attracted, repelled, or
so the surprise is that the constant speed that was given is now produces this rotation because of the fact that you have put in this aligning zone in the middle.
Yes.
Is this the message?
Yes. And so what you can actually see is as you can change the size of this alignment zone, you get very abrupt changes between these different patterns. And so this is the size of that zone of alignment, the zone of orientation. And as we increase it, the group will stay in the swarm-type pattern, but then suddenly, at a critical point, they will suddenly adopt this pattern here, spontaneously. And as we increase it further still, so this is the angular momentum of the group. As we increase it further still, they'll then flip back into the polarized group state. So if you move through parameter space slowly in this direction, so I've increased the size of the zone and run it for a very long time and slowly increased it and so on, then this is what we get, to go from the swarm to the torus to the polarized group. But if I go back through parameter space exactly the same way, then the group will never adopt that torus formation. So what we have here is a bistability, whereby you can get two completely different collective behaviors for exactly the same individual behavior. And so if we're interested in the evolution of collective behavior, we have to begin understanding some of these hysteresis properties that are more common, I think, in the physics literature and in understanding physical systems.
A question. How do you start the simulation with all of them moving in random directions?
Yes.
And with periodic boundary conditions or similar?
No, there's no boundary. It's an infinite space. The groups, for these parameter conditions, the groups will always maintain cohesion.
And all of them start out with random directions?
Well, some random positions, random directions within a sphere such that they can perceive at least one other individual.
Uh-huh.
But, so, I mean, in the paper, there's a more complex analysis of phase space where there's an area where they fragment and so on. And again, there's some interesting work looking at the size of these zones and how rigid the group stays together, because these kind of groups here are really, really strongly attractive. You know, it's hard to break them apart, but they don't really transfer information because they don't have alignment. Whereas these groups here can tend to be a bit more brittle. They can tend to split apart more readily. But that's another topic.
Then I don't understand this hysteresis behavior, because if you start out with random directions,
but
it doesn't matter if you go to the right or if you
But in
go
this
left.
Model here, as I was explaining, I slowly changed the properties and then rerun the model. And slowly changed it, then So in this case, the starting conditions are not random. In the phase space analysis of the model, the starting conditions were random. If you have, in actual fact, this curve here is almost indistinguishable from the random starting conditions. So that's what you get if you use random starting conditions. And we can also look at differences among individuals.
So it's not symmetric. It's really not symmetric going in two directions, because the state
initial state is what's not symmetrical.
That's right. So there's a collective memory in the system. So the system has a memory of its previous states. So even though the individuals themselves don't have any memory, the system itself has a memory of previous state. So that's really what this is showing, is that it's not exactly as he said. And we can also look at differences among individuals in a population. For example, if you have a variation in the zone of orientation within the group, they can spontaneously become assorted. Likewise, if you have a variation in the range of zone of repulsion, individuals with a smaller zone of repulsion will tend to spontaneously find the center of the group. Now that's important. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the muesli effect. If you sort of shake up your cereal, the big bits go to the top and the small bits go to the bottom. But again, this would work within very, very large groups. So if you're really hungry and you need to get to the edge, you can simply modify this behavior, and that will spontaneously mean you go to the edge. But the edge perhaps is quite dangerous. So again, when you've had your fill of food, individuals tend to move to the center of the group. And you don't need a sort of GPS. You don't need to know, you know, where you are with respect to other individuals if you can adopt these different behaviors with respect to your neighbors within a group. And at a population level, if you start looking at fission-fusion systems, so this is just a still image, and you can sort of imagine these groups moving around in space, you can see that groups will spontaneously become assorted according to phenotype, according to their behaviors, without anything in the model to say so. So this, for example, could be different sexes or different species in a population. And this is just showing the degree to which you become assorted in a population as a function in difference of speed or as a function in the difference in that zone of repulsion. Showing that individuals can spontaneously, both within a group and between groups, spontaneously become associated with other individuals that are more similar to themselves without requiring any individual recognition. So say, for example, different individuals of slightly different sizes, which also may have slightly different physiological needs, will spontaneously become associated in populations. So this could, you know, be important in some issues of physiological synchronization, for example. And the alignment zone is also important in terms of transferring information over long ranges. So this is a real fish school being attacked by a predator, and you can see the remarkable responses that they show. And we can then just add a predator within our simulation model, and the only rule that we've added here is if you directly see the predator, you move away. But individuals, of course, don't need to directly be able to see the predator. They can respond to this wave of turning across the groups. Information can propagate across these groups very effectively. And you can sort of stop and rotate around. And so one of the interesting things here is to optimize the model such that they can propagate this collective information. For example, to locate food would be the inverse problem, which is instead of, you know, trying to collectively avoid something, you're trying to collectively find something. So what about differences among individuals in a population? One of the things we're really interested in is that, you know, okay, we've done this modeling to sort of show that you don't need to have leaders in your model. You don't need to have differences to explain these kind of properties. But in nature, we have strong differences in informational quality, strong differences in population. Some individuals have previously performed migrations the year before. Other individuals are completely naive. Can we understand how these simple grouping organisms come to unanimous decisions? And so we published the first part of the theory of this last year, and I want to discuss that and then on to some experimental tests of this idea. So in the case of bees, for example, less than 5% of the bees know where to go, and the swarm will take flight, and somehow that small proportion will guide the whole swarm towards the new nest. Again, you know, with things like these bats, roosting bats, perhaps only a small proportion of individuals have previously foraged successfully the previous day. You know, how can that be transferred? So if you imagine the same kind of model, but some individuals have got knowledge, but this one knows that food is in this direction, or that that's the direction towards a migration route. Does it need to be able to signal that to others? Do these individuals need to be able to recognize other individuals individually to be able to understand this kind of information? So again, using the very simplistic types of models, just with attraction and alignment, we can begin to understand how individuals reconcile their social tendency, their schooling or flocking tendency, with their desire to move in a given direction. So this individual here is coded in red just so we can see which one has information. In the model, no one knows who has and who does not have information. They all start from random positions and random orientations. But this individual here must reconcile those two tendencies, and does so with a simple weighting term. And if that waiting time is very, very low, then it largely ignores its desire to move in a given direction and just schools with the other individuals. However, if it gets really hungry, for example, or it really wants to move in that direction, it may increase the weighting of this vector, and in which case it will have a much stronger influence on its motion. And so what we can then do is look at the proportion of these informed individuals in populations. So if we just have one individual in a group of 100, and the green cross just gives you the centroid, and it's trying to guide the group in this direction, you can see that it doesn't have much success. If we have 5 individuals in the population, we can see that after an initial period of assortment, they tend to guide the group. And if you note, they tend to occupy spontaneously front positions within the group. If we increase the number of individuals still, we can see that very quickly and very accurately they can guide these naive individuals. And so what we see is that the accuracy of this guidance increases and then saturates as the proportion of informed individuals in the population increases. But as we go to large groups, so from a group of 10 towards a group of 200, you can see that the proportion of informed individuals that you need for a given accuracy actually decreases. So for these very, very large groups, you don't need more than about 5% of your individuals to have this information to accurately guide the group. And if it takes a long time or if it's dangerous to acquire this information, then we can show that you really, there's not really much of a benefit, you know, to increasing your efficiency from 90 to sort of 93% by increasing a large number of individuals with information.
Excuse me, in drawing this conclusion that as you simply increase the total number, it becomes sharper, what have you kept the same in all of these?
All of the parameters in the model are the same.
All the parameters except the number?
Yes, that's right. And so what we actually find is that it's really the number of informed individuals in these populations that tends to be determine the motion. So as the group size increases, the proportion that you need decreases. It's because of the structure of the group.
So what is the order of this number?
That's going to be model specific. I think the absolute number is going to be model specific because it relates to the geometry of the groups. And in the paper we have more information about that. In this particular model, there were only about 7 to 10 individuals required for all group sizes that we investigated. But this is a qualitative result. You know, we're not going to say that there's a quantitative result here. I mean, you'd have to see how the other parameters of the model also feed back.
And these numbers in a given model is sharply dimension dependent, or do you only do this for the 3 dimensions or what?
This was in 2 dimensions, and it also works in 3 dimensions. I think scaling would be important in the different dimensions because they form these elongated structures that tend to be guided from the front. And so if these informed individuals can saturate the front of the group, then you can have this huge trail of naive individuals spontaneously being guided.
When you have a predator attacking a flock, then at the beginning there are only a few of these individuals who notice, and maybe they can move. They may also go in different directions, and they have followers coming, and so on. I don't think there's some mutual averaging effect leads to motion. It may be that the initial leaders signal by moving faster, or there must be some signaling going on.
Okay, well, I'll come to that in a second, actually, because we then discuss what happens if there's competing information within groups. We also have experimental data from fish that say there is no signaling. So we try different speeds, for example, of using model fish, and we get I can show you some of the data at least shortly. So one of the other properties that we investigated is this waiting time, how strongly you move in that desired direction. If very few individuals have information, or if everyone has information, then it doesn't really matter how you weight things. You're either going to have no effect or you're going to have a strong effect anyway. But in this case where the few are guiding the many, then increasing weighting strongly increases group accuracy, but comes at a cost of increasing the fragmentation of the group, increasing the probability that the group will break apart. And that's exactly what we get in fish. So we can train fish to guide individuals. If you train them too well, they'll guide them really, they'll get there really quickly, but they'll leave the group behind. If we train them too little, then they'll be able to guide the individuals, but they won't take them anywhere. And so there's this optimal trade-off. And we think that teaching individuals equates to this weighting function here. And so we can then look for differences in experience and motivation in populations. And particularly, we're going to focus on the ability for groups to come to a consensus direction about where to go when you have competing information within the group. So here we could have individuals. This one here wants to go in this direction. This one here wants to go in this direction. And these individuals may have no preference whatsoever. So if we keep one direction always constant at 0 degrees, what we can then do is vary the direction at which the other group wants to go. So if it's also 0 degrees, then they're both in agreement. But we can increase the degree to which they disagree here up to 180 degrees, where they want to go in exactly the opposite directions. And then we can run many, many simulations and look at the probability of a group going in these two different directions. And also, just for our benefit, the white line shows you the average direction of the group. And so I'm going to use 100 individuals in which 5 of them, randomly positioned, random orientations, want to go one way, and 5 want to go another way. And no one knows who has and who doesn't have information. And they don't know if anyone else is in agreement with them, or you know, even if there are any other informed individuals. And what we can see is that for these differences in opinion here, the group will spontaneously adopt the average direction of the group. But when we get to a critical point here, the group will spontaneously go either one way or the other. This is not the group breaking apart. We're looking at parameter conditioning. The group always stays together. But we can see here that half of the time one of these groups will win, and half of the time the other group will win out. But what about if we add just one more individual to one of those subsets? So instead of 5 and 5, I'm now going to add one more individual to this group here. And what we can show is that even in the presence of noise and that there's random starting conditions, these 6 individuals will spontaneously win out. That the group can accurately come to a consensus decision about the majority direction, even in the absence of signaling. And we can also investigate how we can change the point at which we go from the averaging to the consensus decision making. So if we allow individuals to lose their preferences if they're not successful, if they tend not to go in the direction they wanted to go, we can change the point at which this occurs. Now, if we start dealing with, instead of just directions, we start dealing with targets in space, we can see that a group here, if some individuals want to get to the white target and some want to get to the red target, if they're very, very far away, this angle is going to be small and they're going to be in the averaging phase. But as they get, and that will be sort of the green direction, but as they get closer, they'll get to the point at which they've reached the bifurcation and they'll spontaneously select one of those two locations. So you can see the group going through the averaging phase. This is without feedback, so they don't have any ability to forget. But even in that simple case, they'll still spontaneously select a direction. And that was an equal number wanting to go to white or red. And now I just add one more individual who wants to go to the white target, and the group will spontaneously almost always get to the right target, the majority target. But this other region in parameter space too, if the weighting term is really quite high and individuals aren't willing to really come to a compromise, then we can get a sort of fission-fusion system where groups can split apart, taking some naive individuals with them. And of course, you know, if individuals can learn about locations of resources, this is how information can spread in populations. There's also another area...
So it takes longer if there's a split. It looked like it took longer to get with a 6-4... Is the time affected by the number of individuals in different groups?
Yes, it is. So if the weighting isn't so strong, we can actually have another region in parameter space where the group will spontaneously oscillate between targets. And if you give them more than 2 targets, they'll spontaneously form track lines between those different targets without changing the rules of the model at all. And so what happens is when you get to a target, all of the individuals that wanted to get there are then going to be pointing in different directions, whereas the individuals wanting to go to the other target are all going to generally have the same direction vector, and so then they'll begin to win out. And then the group will charge towards the other target and then get to the reverse situation, and then they'll oscillate between the two. So natural selection, by modifying this simple weighting term, could potentially allow groups to go through this sort of exploratory phase and also allow them to collectively come to consensus decisions. And we can also show that the group can spontaneously select the direction associated with least uncertainty. So if individuals' vectors are not exactly the same, but there's a sort of noise, then the group will spontaneously select the direction associated with the least noise. And so the predictions are that a small minority of individuals can lead groups, and also that when there's a difference in preference, the group can collectively select the direction associated with the majority. So we're doing ongoing experiments both with human crowds and with fish schools, to look at these properties. So in the case of humans, we have students that are randomly, we position them in a circle here, and their directions are randomly selected, their starting positions are randomly selected. And they're not allowed to talk to each other because we're simulating an evacuation procedure. So one of these exits here is safe, and they don't know which one it is. And so we can then modify, you know, how many individuals know the safe exit, how many don't know it. We can then put in conflicting information, and we can then film them as they evacuate. And we can see that even if we add just one informed individual into the group, they'll spontaneously, without any communication, locate the target. And as we have more informed individuals, their variance becomes smaller. So a small minority can lead these groups. And also,
and
if we have...
they don't know who is the informed...
No. Yeah. We interview them at the end, and they don't know what the game was. They don't know what the, they don't know what the experiment was. They don't. So they just get a card that tells them which way they want to go. And we can show that if we have a difference in opinion in these groups, that they can spontaneously select the majority direction. In the case of... We also did some experiments where we're interested in the costs of leadership, you know, whether there's a potential cost. So we get our groups, here's just two students, to walk through essentially what's a little maze here. And on where these stars are, there are a certain number of dots. And they simply have to get through there quite quickly and count the number of dots. And so we can have a leader and a follower. So they go up this corridor, then along here, then down this corridor. And what we can show that there's a significant cost to leadership, and that the error of the mathematical ability in this case tends to be higher if you're a leader. So if you're a follower, you can sort of just, you know, you've got a bit more processing power. You can perform these simple mathematical tasks more efficiently. In the case of fish, we can do similar experiments where we have two fish, say, versus two fish, or one fish versus one fish, and we can then look at the proportion going in each direction. And we can show that if there's no asymmetry, the group will collectively select one direction or the other, but if we have this small asymmetry, they'll collectively select the majority direction. Again, in the case of predators, we can put a predator down one side, and we can have different groups of fish, and they'll never go past the predator. They'll see it and they'll never go past it. But we can have model fish going past the predator. And so that, say we have two model fish going past the predator, these fish that would normally never do it will then suddenly switch. And so there'll be enough feedback for them to actually adopt this potential direction, showing that they really do use information from other individuals when making movement decisions, even very important movement decisions. And so to move on to the stuff that we really started with Steve Simpson, is we're also interested in issues of mass migration and these selfish bands of marching locusts. And what we really want to try and understand is when, where, and why do these swarms form this large-scale collective motion? And also what biological processes underlie it? And so this really does link in with what the work that I've been doing with Steve. And so here we go, here's the standard locust swarm. This is what people typically think of as a locust swarm. But as Steve explained before, in actual fact, they form swarms before they get wings. And if we're going to understand where and when swarms form, we need to understand where the juvenile hoppers, before they get wings, will form these two-dimensional swarms. And so they'll dry out, and after a short period of time, they'll begin to collectively march together in a common direction. And so we've done a series of field experiments to investigate this, where we work in Mauritania with colleagues there. And that was my lunch. That was the camel entrails, which made me very, very sick. And Steve showed you the field site. And this is the sandstorm that came and ruined all the experiments. But it's important to understand what's going on here for several reasons. Not only is it so intellectually fascinating, but during plagues, it's estimated that these locusts affect 1 in 10 people on the planet. And understanding where this will form is critical. And there's very, very little work done on this. The last really good work in this area was done in the 50s. And in a recent review, it was considered that fighting locusts is still more of an art than a science. So we're interested in what's the relationship between the density and the collective motion of individuals. And so we have... Oh, this slide's not quite working. So this work was really led by, the authors are up here, by Jerome Boulle, who's now a postdoc with Steve Simpson in Sydney. And Jerome put these locusts in an experimental arena, as Steve showed, and we can look in great detail using the computer vision software to understand how the density affects this collective motion, how the individual interactions scale to this large-scale motion. And this simulates in a reasonable space, you know, this sort of never-ending swarm in a sort of simplified desert environment. So we manipulated the density of individuals. We went from 10 to 120 individuals in our arena. And these experiments are actually quite tough to do. I mean, it took 51 day-long experiments. But the really nice thing about it is that we don't have to do the tracking. The computer will sit there and not get bored and get all of the positions and directions of all of our individuals. So we can begin to understand, this is a bit like the angular momentum. We call it the average alignment. And this here would be rotating clockwise, and here rotating counterclockwise in our experiments. So these are the real locusts. So at low densities, you can see that they move in both directions and there's not really order. As we start increasing density, we get to this point of intermittency where the group will rotate clockwise and then very, very quickly start rotating the other direction. And one of the really interesting things is how and why do this intermittency occur? And when we look at more dense populations, we can see the group will spontaneously select one direction and rotate that direction for the 8-hour experiment. So this reminded us of some simplistic models of self-propelled particles that I'm sure most people here know about. And we actually, this is just for illustrative purposes, we actually used the one-dimensional version of the Wieczek model to try and understand whether these simplistic models that were originally derived from magnetic spins have similar properties. And this is the results from the model showing the transition to collective motion. And you can see there's a remarkable similarity between the simple model predictions and the real locusts. And so if we compare, these are sort of all of our experiments shown on the same figure. And if we compare the theory, this transition to order, is quite similar to what we get within the real system. And here we can see the total time spent in the ordered phase and the total number of direction changes as a function of density in the locust experiments and as predicted by the simple self-propelled particle model. So we can show that directed collective motion occurs suddenly, spontaneously, above a critical density, and that a very simple model really captures the essential dynamics of this transition. So at low densities there was no collective motion, and at high density strong collective motion, but at densities associated with the transition we have this rapid spontaneous change in direction. And this really, I mean, I think it's quite remarkable that such a simple model can account for the types of properties we get within a real biological system. I mean, admittedly, we chose the locusts because they were as simple to a subpropelled particle model as we could think of. And, you know, nonlinear statistical physicists, you know, would think about universality and would imagine that the type of transition would be independent of the details of the particles. So we can predict the density at which locusts will spontaneously form mass migrations. And then we can go and ask the FAO what the density tends to be, and it seems to concur. We can also make the prediction that that intermittency could be important in allowing the system to be sensitive to changes of direction. So if some individuals locate food, for example, it could percolate through the group. And indeed, the prediction of the densities at which that will occur is very similar to the average density of locusts in the field. So this is kind of looking at the same locust problem that Steve talked about in a different way. You know, looking here at how information percolates through groups. And we're now doing a series of experiments whereby we're looking at much larger densities of much smaller insects. And this is, Jerome did this experiment relatively recently. And you can see that initially there's disorder. But after a period of time, you'll begin to see sort of maybe some coordinated moving groups around the edges. And you'll actually see these moving groups pass through each other initially. And as time progresses, the system becomes more and more organized and they'll spontaneously adopt the same direction. So we're planning to continue this type of research, looking at these much higher densities to look at the dynamics of these transitions. And any ideas you have will be much appreciated for where we go from here. We're really interested in how you can scale from individual rules to these large groups. You know, how can individuals at this side of a swarm be coordinated with individuals there when there's noise in the system. And this is something that we actually started at the last IPAM meeting. In discussions, we started thinking about this problem for the first time. And so, here is a case where the locusts are tending to be aligning with each other, and you can see that they make these little short hops. So we got interested in the idea as to whether these hops are important. So if you look at the density of insects in a simulated self-propelled particle model, and look at the probability of them making a hop, we can then look to see the order. So that's how collectively directed the motion is. And if I just show you the model. So this is a much, much smaller version of the same model, just for computer time. So you can see these self-propelled particles here are interacting with each other with no hops. And there's never any sort of strong long-range collective order organization. However, if you start adding hops into the model, I'll just speed. Oops. You can see that collectively they'll begin to select a direction. And we can look to see the transition from disorder to order as a function of hop length in the model. So if the hop length is just two body lengths, then you need a heck of a lot of hopping and you still don't get much order. But as we start increasing the hop length to 4, 6, 8 body lengths, you can see there's a large region of parameter space where these locusts will collectively select the same direction. And we can actually then look at the transition between disorder and order as a function of the jump length in two models, one where there were short forward hops and one with short random hops. And we can compare that to if the insects were able to infinitely hop a kilometer to the other side of the swarm. And we can see that the actual hop length tends to be quite similar to the prediction of the model. So this is just something that perhaps we could continue thinking about while we're here.
Excuse me. What you're talking about changing the hop length is this must be a ratio of the length to some interaction distance. Is this true?
That's absolutely true, yes.
I
did this probably in the 2 weeks after the last IPAM meeting. So I haven't a clue what the interaction length is, but I bet you it's about 5 or 6 body lengths. And that the hop length is also in the order of about 5 or 6 body lengths at that transition. So I don't know whether there's something fundamental about that, those exact properties.
In the H length, you mean length on which the velocity is aligned?
Yes. Okay. I literally threw these in at the last minute because it was an IPAM thing that we thought of here.
Are there things like repulsion and so on that you talked about?
Yes, there's repulsion within one body
so
length.
So could it be, in fact, that it is the ratio of the hop length to that repulsion length?
No, I don't think so, no. There's some interesting properties. I thought at this critical hop length, the system would become super connected, and it would be like a small world network, essentially. Absolutely not the case. In actual fact, if you look at the maximum group size, it suddenly decreases before the increase in order. So essentially, what we're creating isn't one big super connected swarm, but actually hundreds of thousands of tiny little swarms that tend to interact with each other every now and again.
But have you done the following? Once you have found out that you've got the results for a certain hop length,
mm-hmm.
if you were to in fact change this length that I just talked
yes.
about, which is the repulsion length,
yes.
Would you be able to see whether you can reverse this or
yeah, absolutely. This is a great idea, and that is all the sort of stuff we need to do. If we think this is actually interesting, which I'm not convinced it is, but if we decide that it is interesting, then these are exactly the sort of things that we should do. I actually think what's going on is it's the probability of you interacting with another individual per unit time is important. So you should have an optimal amount of ignoring other individuals.
Question. How are you introducing the noise into the system?
Here
what about it? All these quantities depends on the...
Gaussian noise.
Gaussian
noise. Yeah, so you add a Gaussian vector with a standard deviation equal to the noise parameter to the desired direction.
I'd like to ask people to hold off on questions so we can.
Yeah, I'm just finishing. So really, what we're trying to do is really begin to link together through lab and field experiments to sort of experiments that Steve Simpson's now leading in Australia, where we're doing field surveys and aerial photography, up to large scale modelling of these types of properties. So we need to understand. Link together all of these different things, the biology on the propensity to move, the nutritional state that Steve talked about, to the probability that you meet conspecifics, and how that affects with population density. And importantly, as Steve was discussing, this rule of cannibalism, which feeds back into all of these different properties. So, and we've hardly discussed habitat structure or predation. So we really need to, this is just the start. And I just like to say, Stephanie Bazzazzi was the student who did the nerve cut experiments that Steve talked about, and all of the other people have collaborated with this stuff. Thanks very much for listening.